Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Erin Davidson. Erin has been working within zoos and wildlife parks for the last 20 years, currently working at Sydney's Tooronga Zoo's Free Flight Bird Show, training a variety of birds from Andean condors, eagles, to parrots and chickens. During this time, she has also created a pet show, educating visitors on responsible pet ownership, and has had the opportunity to train dogs in the musical Annie. Erin has spent time learning from trainers overseas, including Bob Bailey, Ken Ramirez, and Steve Martin, working on the Symphony of Flight Bird Show at San Diego Zoo and a Birds of the World Show at the Dallas State Fair. Erin's passion has always been learning new techniques and building trust within the animals she works with, and in her words, giving them the confidence to soar. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Erin Davidson to the show today, who is patiently waiting by in Sydney, Australia. Erin, how are you doing today?
Hello, I'm very good, thank you.
And thank you for making time for this. The podcast audience can't see it, but you're hunkered in your daughter's bedroom while grandma's looking
after. I'm escaping her. Yeah, that's right. She's asleep at the moment, so hopefully grandma will have a good run while I'm doing this interview with you.
Well, you're welcome for this opportunity to escape so we can benefit from your 20 years, your amazing 20 years of experience working at Tooronga Zoo and other wildlife parks. So thank you for making time for this.
Pleasure.
Hey, let's dive into the first question today, Erin. Could you please take everyone listening back to where you got started, where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training, and share some stories from that time?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I've been, ever since I was a little kid, always wanted to work with animals. And pretty much straight out of high school, I ended up volunteering at a different wildlife park and getting jobs in there. So I've always worked with birds and Australian mammals throughout the years. And I've always been keen to learn how to train them. You know, behaviour's always been a big thing for me, always wanting to watch the birds in the aviaries interact with each other. And I was lucky enough that I had a few friends that were in the training field. One of my positions, though, had another small wildlife park. There was a trainer, and I remember asking him if it was all right if he gave me a few pointers, some tips, and he was quite happy to help. This was at the very start of my career, so this would have been like 19, 18 years ago. So you could imagine, I guess, some of the tips that he would have, you know, taught upon me back then. And I was lucky that he didn't really have that much time for me because a lot of the training techniques that he was trying to teach upon me were things like, you know, you have to have a parrot down low because of a thing called height dominance. So you have to be towering over this parrot, have the parrot in the corner of the room, because these are the things that are going to make you more successful in training. And you know, I'm just so glad that he didn't have that much time for me, because you never know where you're going to be. You look at these mentors, and you know, sometimes you just think that what they're talking about is right. But it wasn't until I actually got a job at the bird show at Sydney where, you know, it just opened my eyes to, I guess, a light of what actually it means to be able to train an animal. You know, training an animal was just about building confidence, you know, and building that trust with that relationship. And I had the opportunity to work with so many amazing trainers that are still working at the bird show now. I think most, at least half of the people there have been there for over 15 years. So it was just great to be able to have that chance to educate myself further. And from that, you know, doing Susan Friedman's LLA courses and really trying to get a good understanding about behavior change. And with birds, you know, I've had dogs my whole life and have dabbled with training with them beforehand. But, you know, I feel like it makes you quite a good trainer when you can get this bird that's just so nervous of you and, you know, you have to try to use your skills in training to turn them around to have that trust. And once you have a bird feeding from your glove for the first time, it's pretty amazing. So, I'm very grateful for being able to work at that bird show and have those amazing trainers teach me a thing or two about positive reinforcement.
And for all our dog training and horse training folk out there, when you say feeding a bird from a glove, can you unpack what that means? Well, I'm like in my bird nerd little spot of heaven right now going, hey, let's talk about birds. But
birds, yeah. Well, so basically with a lot of the raptors mainly, not the parrots or anything, you do have to there is a level of PPE that goes on with the job. You know, these are birds that have got extremely sharp and strong talons. And so when you do have them on your hand, you do have to wear a leather glove just to help protect your hand. Even if they don't mean to, those nails will just pierce through your skin. So, and so a lot of the times when we are offering pieces of food, we would put a little bit of food into our glove and just with an open hand, just reach it up for them so they can take it out and eat it. So it's just more of a safety matter. With parrots, of course, you just kind of offer it through just a bare hand, but you know they've got sharp beaks too, so you do have to be wary.
And do you use the word gauntlet, or is that more of a European word?
Gauntlet? I've never heard of gauntlet before.
Gauntlet? No, you haven't heard of gauntlet before?
No.
Okay. There's Ryan making things up, everyone. And so you're at this wildlife park and you're grateful that someone you'd ask questions for didn't have time for you. Not at the time you weren't grateful, but in hindsight, you've become grateful that they were too busy to offer you advice. Or at the time, did you kind of see that the advice that they were giving you wasn't correct? Did you know in your kind of limited experience at a time?
I think deep down I did. I mean, I was just very excited that I got the opportunity to, you know, work with someone. I think out of the whole few years that I was there, I think I maybe had 3 training sessions with him. So I didn't really get to dove in deeply with it. But yeah, there were definitely times where it made me feel a bit uncomfortable and even made me want to doubt the fact that I wanted to train an animal because I never really wanted to, you know, be a trainer that trains in that way, I guess.
And then so you were lucky to get a job at Taronga Zoo, you said, after this.
Yeah, that's right. So I actually started at the bird department and worked a couple of years on the bird department looking after the aviary species. And then within the zoo, part of the criteria for grading and going up in levels is that you have to have experience within different fields of the zoo. And so we do 6-month rotations. So you get to work 6 months on another section just to try to get new skills. And so the opportunity for me to come up to work 6 months on bird show. And so I took it and absolutely loved it. And the person that I swapped with ended up getting a job somewhere else. So that job became available. And I just think it all played out so nicely for me at that time. So I was there doing the role, the job came up, and I was lucky enough to get it.
And how long has the show been going at Taronga Zoo for now?
The bird show has been, it's been going just over 20 years now. So it's been a while. And believe it or not, there are I think there's maybe one bird that has been there the whole time, still flying in the show. So,
who's that?
Yeah, so we've seen
what bird's that?
A slammer, the black-breasted buzzard.
Ah, yeah, cool.
Yeah, so she's the one that uses a rock to smash an open an emu egg. So, she's a pretty cool bird. So, there's a lot of reliable birds that are, you know, they probably know the job better than I do.
And a lot of people listening to the show won't know what a black-breasted buzzard is. You said they pick up a rock to smash an emu egg. We didn't plan to talk about black-breasted buzzard, but they're such a cool behavior. And like I said, most of the listeners of the show won't know about that. So I just want to seize this opportunity because it's such a cool geek-out moment. Can you just tell everyone listening a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is a bird that's found around Central Australia. So they don't just eat emu eggs. They will eat smaller things like mammals and reptiles, maybe small birds. But they definitely enjoy eggs. Smaller eggs, they'll just probably pick up and smash and eat themselves. But if they ever come across an emu egg, instinct has just taught them to pick up a rock to try to get into it because their beak and their talons are just not strong enough. So they actually hatch out of their own egg with the knowledge of how to feed upon these emu eggs. So it's pretty amazing to think about that. I think there's only one other bird in the world that uses a rock to get into eggs, and that's the Egyptian vulture over in Africa. So it's a pretty cool and unique skill.
Well, I've had the pleasure of seeing Slammer a couple of times, I think, over the years. As you said, there's one bird, at least, Slammer, who's been in the show for the whole time, and there's a couple of staff members who have been there for long periods of time as well. And some past podcasts of the Animal Training Academy show have also been your colleagues.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, and again, as I said, I've been just so lucky to work with these amazing people. Like there's a man, Matthew Kettle. He's the one who actually helped start and create the show. So he's been there from the whole time. He's the supervisor of the show. Peter Clark, who you've done a podcast with, she worked there for a couple of years while I was there. And having the opportunity to work with her as well. She's got a pretty amazing mind, that one. And so when she starts to teach, which she loves to teach, you know, you just walk away from sessions just with a whole new light on what actually happened.
And our great mutual friend who actually suggested this podcast episode, our friend Nick Bishop. You worked with him for a while as well?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I had the opportunity to work with Nick for a couple of years. He was there when I first started. And yeah, I mean, this man is a genius when it comes to creativity. You know, he had a lot to play with script development as well. And you know, watching him work, it was always fun. I think him and I had a pair of galahs that we trained at the same time together. This galah was actually my first bird that I got to train, and he had the other one. So we were he was my mentor through it. And, you know, and it was actually a pretty cool training experience, that one, because even though those two birds were siblings from the same nest, they were completely different in their behaviors. And it just goes to show, I know, you know, one of the themes from a conference we just went to is behavior is the study of one. Well, this definitely pinpointed that to me, where we just had Nick's bird was actually, we called him Jimbo and mine was Nelson. Yes, I like the Simpsons. So Jimbo, he was just so confident. And so the way that Nick went about training him was quite different to how I had to go about training mine, because mine just tended to always just be that a little bit more nervous. And I guess because they were grown up together and lived together, Nelson really did rely on Jimbo's company to be confident as well. And so we used that as a technique within their training. That was kind of a cool thing that I got to do with Nick.
And all the English people are saying, galah, what? Isn't that just what Alf Stewart says on Home and Away? It is an actual bird, people.
Yes, beautiful pink.
Can you describe to everyone what a galah is?
Yeah, so a galah it's a small parrot, but they're just such a vibrant pink and whites. And they do actually in the wild hang around in flocks of thousands sometimes. So, you know, if you get to stumble across them in the wild like that, they're very loud and very boisterous kind of parrots, and they're really cool to work with.
So they've earned the name Bing at Galar, as referenced by Alf Stewart on Home and Away. I don't even know if Home and Away is still going. Is it? Is Alf still going?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Alf's still on Home and Away, yeah.
Either lots of people know what I'm talking about or no one knows what I'm talking about. But so Nick Bishop and Peter Clark, like we said, they've been on previous ATA podcast episodes, so we'll link to them in the write-up for Erin's episode and have that nice little 1 degree of separation between guests on the show. So 20 years, I mean, not just at Tauranga Zoo Bird Show, as we've talked about, you're at, in other departments at the zoo and you're at another wildlife park as well. But I'm assuming over that time you've seen a lot of changes, you've seen a lot of things shift. Yes, no?
Definitely.
What can you share with us some of the changes that you've seen happen over your career when training birds? We often talk about dogs and horses, but what kind of things have you seen change with regards to how we train birds?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the things I think I loved about going to Susan Friesman's conference is she really made the statement that, you know, when you've got your primary reinforcers, it's not just food and water and shelter. One of them's control as well. So giving that animal control of the environment. And so I feel like that has really starting to shine through bird shows. You know, there was a time and you know, and it's still a technique that gets used today where a lot of the raptors are just tethered. And what tethered means is when you're looking at, and this is only for raptor species because they've got such strong, powerful legs, a lot of the times they have leather straps around their ankles, and from that they have a thing called a jess, which is basically a small little bit of leather strap. So when they're on your hand, you can actually hold on to them. But from that, they get tethered to a small station with a small rope. And so they really don't have that opportunity to move around an enclosure. You know, they can be put to an outside area where they can get some sun and some water and some light, but they can't really move from where they are. So from what I've seen from the last even 10 years of training is that people are starting to move away from that. None of our birds are tethered at the zoo. They've all got a huge aviary that they can fly around in. And so giving them the choice to actually move forward and to participate, I think, is huge. You know, it gives you just so much information of where that bird's head's at as well. So when you're starting a show, if that bird's sitting up the back of the aviary, well, if you go in and throw it outside for a show and it's telling you that it doesn't really want to participate today, well, then you're going to have a bird that might take off, which I, you know, wouldn't blame it if it's not getting listened to. So a lot of the training and a lot of the things that we do these days is really just watching the animal's behavior, and if it's not wanting to come forward to participate for show, well, then we try to assess why and try to make it make changes so it wants to come forward. And so I think that's really exciting, and I'd like to, you know, I think that's just a part of the training that makes you appreciate, you know, especially when you have a sick or injured wild bird that will come forward to you to participate is cool.
Yeah, and for people that don't know, birds of prey, tethering, jesses, all of this equipment, it's got a rich and long history, doesn't it? It's not something that we've just started doing over the last 4 years.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, falconry has been, gosh, for tens of thousands of years, you know, it still gets used in traditional hunting and things like that. And, you know, there's some areas where I do see a bit of a place of holding jesses. You know, we definitely will still hold jesses if we need to. If the bird's in any danger, you know, we've had times where we're flying birds at a park and there might be a dog off lead. And so, of course, we want to make sure that that animal is safe and secure with us. But more importantly, I think we try to encourage the bird to want to stay on our hand and not just be there because it's being held. But yeah, as I said, tethering is something that gets used with raptors. You know, I have, I remember going into a bookshop when I was first starting out wanting to learn how to train, and I've got a training book out and it had a picture of a cockatoo that was tethered to a perch. And so, yeah, things have definitely changed, but I would not recommend any kind of tethering or holding jesses for parrots or really any other birds other than raptors, because their legs aren't designed for it, and you could really cause injury. So all the parrots are all within our bird show are all free lofted, and you know you're using the same techniques as you would with the raptors.
I guess if you're at the park with a wedge-tailed eagle on your glove, you're also worried about the safety of the dog.
Yes. You've seen some expressions of some people's faces that have little small, like Bichon Frise kind of dogs kind of picking them up very swiftly to take them away. But, you know, but not everybody is aware of their environment. There's so many times where we could be flying an eagle or an Andean condor or anything at a park and people walk past not even noticing. So, yeah, so you do have to be wary about those things.
And just as to put it into a frame that a lot of the listeners of the show might be more familiar with, we're thinking like having a lead on a horse or a dog for safety purposes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep. So
but,
it just kind
not
of
using it for training purposes per se.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And a dimension that bird trainers, dog trainers often don't have to think about is something you mentioned earlier, that if your bird moves to the back of the aviary and you still get it out, for example, to fly in a show, that bird might take off. Now, we don't have to worry about dogs taking off or horses taking off. When I say take off, I mean using wings to leave the physical earth and go off into the sky. Like, what kind of skill level do you think that adds to bird trainers with regards to the fact that the birds can just go?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it really you just have to be quite sensitive to the bird, but you have to really be able to read the body language and pick things up, you know. You kind of need to know when to, you know, end sessions to say, you know, we always have a bit of a running joke. Let's just do one more rep because we're having so much success. But, you know, sometimes it's that one more rep that gets you into trouble. But so, yeah, you really do have to make sure that you're reading each training session to make sure that they don't just take off. But it's also assessing, you know, I guess it goes back to the ABCs that we talk about with Susan Friedman's kind of talk. You really want to check the antecedents. So that environment, is it safe? Is there a wild white-bellied seagull flying around and you're about to bring a bunch of cockatoos out to fly? You know, if that's the case, well, then I'm not bringing those cockatoos out to fly, because guarantee they're going to see that bird and disappear. Why wouldn't you? You know, it's part of their instinct to save their lives, kind of thing, you know. So it's, yeah, having a look at your antecedents, the area that you're in, watching the body language of the bird, all of these things before you actually even ask for a behavior. So, yeah, I've had a couple of fun experiences of chasing birds, but
Tell more.
Oh, gosh. You know what? I think the biggest thing I would have to think would be those red-tailed black cockatoos. We have a group of four that fly at the end of show, and they get pretty high. They circle around and then come down to a tree that's on stage before they exit back into the building. And especially around winter, I guess, when you've got good southerlies and that, when the wind can be a little bit more strong. We've had a couple of times where, you know, as I said, a white-bellied seagull will come past. We've actually had a wild peregrine falcon chase them. And I just remember being on stage looking up at these birds, just, you know, in heart in my mouth, thinking, please just get to safety, where this peregrine falcon has started to chase them. And we've been so lucky that nothing's ever happened. But, of course, we're a bird show that's on the side of a cliff right on the harbour. So for them to travel 2 minutes, they're across the harbour. and so you just see them flying across to the other side of the harbour. So what took them 2 minutes is going to take us 45 minutes to hop into the car, put the cages that we can secure them in once that we've get them back, drive all the way over, find them. And then normally when we see them, they're like, okay, you're familiar, I'll come down to you, because we've had that relationship. So again, you could imagine not using positive reinforcement. If a bird flies off, why would it want to come back to you in those circumstances? So, having that trust, that relationship built using positive techniques, that burden normally pretty quickly comes down to you as soon as it sees you, and then you can put it in the nagel and take it home. So, yeah, we've had a couple of fun instances like that. But now we've actually, just in the last couple of years, we've got some new technology. We have a GPS tracking system that we can attach to pretty much all of the birds, except for some of the parrots. Parrots, they're chewers. So there's a couple of parrots that you can put them on and they just chew them straight off. Plus they live in big flocks. They might get groomed. It's, you know, that's changed so much from when I first started. Before, you'd just have to drive around and listen and hope for the best, or if someone calls in saying that they've found a bird. But now it's just attached to your iPhone. I've got an app for this, which is pretty crazy to think about. So I can just press my app and it sends me a satellite signal of where the bird is. But the coolest thing about this app as well, we put it on our peregrine falcon and it tells you the speed, the distance, you know, how high they got, and can leaves you a little bit of a map of that information. So some pretty cool technology for situations like that. So it kind of takes the stress out of it a little bit when you kind of know where that bird is the whole time.
Yeah, well, I remember we never had any of that when I was doing free flight bird shows. We'd be running around with our big antennae and our telemetry gear, listening for little beeps on our radio.
Gosh, yes. And there are still some birds like that, but yeah, God, it takes the stress out of it when you're just relying on this beep, beep kind of noise. Like, okay, got it.
Now, explain to everyone listening who might not know how terrifying it is to see a peregrine falcon of all birds coming after your parrots.
Peregrine falcon in particular. Yeah, like, you know, you have a white-bellied seagull, they don't cause too much problems except for the fact that they scare them. But peregrine falcons are bird eaters. You know, these are birds that are just designed for hunting and for being fast and good at it. So when you have a peregrine falcon in the area, I'm surprised that we have been as lucky as we have been, to tell you the truth. So you could just imagine me watching them standing on stage, because there's just nothing you can do at that time bar hope that the birds have got enough skill within themselves to get out of that situation, and that potentially that peregrine falcon isn't as hungry as you know, it could be. You know, if it was a hungry bird, well, then it probably would have made a little bit more effort to try to catch one of our cockatoos. So it was great to see the peregrine falcon disappear and all our birds come home. I can just say that.
I can imagine. Hey, you also mentioned there before that Taronga's Bird Show is right on a cliff on the harbour now. Sounds nice, but that doesn't do justice to how amazing the backdrop of Taronga's bird show is. I've always said it's got the best backdrop of any bird show in the world. Can you, just before we move on to what we're going to talk about for the meat of this episode, even though we're half an hour and I know that everyone, tell everyone a little bit about the show. Explain to people what they're going to see when they're sitting in the grandstand looking out at the stage.
So we're extremely lucky. We've got a really spectacular backdrop. So we've got a theatre that I think seats about 800 or so people sitting. And the backdrop is Sydney Harbour. So you can see the Sydney Harbour Bridge, the Opera House, Centrepoint Tower. You know, it's a beautiful skyline. And so that also, you know, in saying that, it has its good and its bad elements about it, because where we're situated, right on the cliff, if we get, say, southerlies to westerlies, it's perfect wind condition for us, because the wind can get up to, you know, around the 30 to 40 k's an hour. If it gets to 50 k's, we cancel show. But it just allows for some pretty spectacular flight. So we have a tower that we load our Andean condor and our wedge-tailed eagle in, and it goes 20 metres above ground. So the birds kind of start off from a height. And I know one of your favourite birds that you used to work with, Reggie, our wedge-tailed eagle, he does, you know, there's times where I've actually teared up on stage to watch him fly. You know, he can be out there for 10 minutes sometimes just flying around. And you just watch him and just the skill that he has, how he can just use the wings, you know, to dip in. He comes and sometimes it looks like he's coming into his tree on stage, but then he will take off again. And, you know, just listening to the audience reaction of going, whoa, you know, it's and even sometimes he can be a pinprick in the sky and you tap the tree and he just, you know, you can just see those wings tuck in, the landing gear, his feet kind of come down and he just drops down to that tree. It's pretty spectacular to see him fly. So yeah, on good windy conditions, we kind of fight out the back to see who's doing the show because it's pretty fun. We have kites that we throw pieces of meat up that they catch in the air and everything. But as I said, there is that flip side. Sometimes there's no wind and, you know, we still get some good flying, but it might be a lot shorter. But sometimes if it's coming from different angles, you know, it can hit the trees and kind of turn into a bit of a circular motion, so a bit more gustier. And so we have had birds kind of, you know, as they're flying might be just a little bit hard for them and they'll land in a tree or something like that. So but yeah, so if you come to the zoo, try to pick it on a nice windy southerly day and you expect to see some pretty cool things, I think.
Yeah, where can people go to find out more about Taronga Zoo and the show?
Yes, so we have a website, just tarongazoo.org. And that will tell you all the different shows that we have, tell you a little bit about our show. One of the biggest things, I think, with our show is we do try to have some action messages as well within it. So one of the big things, we talk about hollow logs and we try to relate to people as much as possible by talking about these are birds that you can actually see in your backyard. And it doesn't have to necessarily be in the country. It's, you know, in the city as well. And so nest boxes are a huge thing that we want to try to educate people on because, you know, hollow logs are a natural nest box for not just birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians. So there's a lot of competition for them. And, you know, it can take hundreds of years for them to form, but a lot of them are getting chopped down because we're making cities, schools, roads, all of that. But you can actually build your own nest boxes and put them up in your backyard. And so these are the things that we're trying to educate people on. And there's actually a link on our website at thetaronga.org. If you type in that with put nest boxes, it will take you to the site where, you know, it gives you the different dimensions for different animals, you know, so you can just ring up your local council, find out what animals you might have in your area and just build a nest box and it tells you how far off the ground it needs to be. And so just things like that, I think, is a great way to try to make a difference within everybody else's backyard kind of thing to help encourage the populations out there to go strong.
Yeah, well, I'll link to that actual nest boxing building page on the write-up for this episode because life out there in the wild is hard. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about this now because moving forward, I want to continue to geek out about training birds and talk about something we haven't really discussed on the show before. And this is how you would train a wild bird of prey. So let's imagine a bird's coming to you guys in need of help. It's been found in the wild. It's young, sick, or injured. And you've been tasked with training this bird either for release or, if unreleasable, to potentially be trained to live life in human care. Erin, you're going to walk us through now 10 steps to how you would do this, how you would train a wild bird of prey, and kindly going to share examples of both a wedge-tailed eagle and a peregrine falcon. I'm excited to dive in. I briefly mentioned some possible reasons already, but maybe start with why a wild bird of prey might end up in your care in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, our vet clinic gets a lot of animals in each year, thousands and thousands. And one of the main reasons why you would probably find a wedge-tailed eagle or a raptor come into care would be, you know, it's a hard life for them out there. They have to learn how to hunt and feed themselves in urban areas as well. So, you know, we always go through boom and bust. So sometimes there's a lot of food availability and sometimes there's just not. So a lot of the times we get a lot of birds in that are maybe a first year bird. So birds that are, you know, around the 1 to 2 years old, where they just haven't got the skills that they need to be able to survive, whether it be just that there's not enough food or whether they're just, you know, within themselves unable to hunt. And so we do get a lot of birds that come in that have just been starving. So a lot of the times people might try to feed them up and release them again. But if it's because they don't know how to hunt, then they tend to just end up back in captivity. So a lot of the times, a lot of the birds that we get in are fit that category. And so that, I guess, to us for a bird show, you know, they can fly. They still get to you know, live that life of soaring high and flying, but they have food availability and veterinary care as well on top of that. So if they don't come into care because of just being hungry and starving, not being able to find food, they've probably been injured. Cats, cars, human impact are a lot of the reasons why birds will come into our care.
And so let's say we've got, well, let's talk about this wedge-tailed eagle and this peregrine falcon. Can you briefly share their stories and we'll blend that into your 10 steps that you take?
Yeah, okay, definitely. So Gina, she was our wedge-tailed eagle. We don't really know much about her. We know that she was an older bird just because of the colour of her. Normally a wedge-tailed eagle, when they're young, they're actually quite light and blonde in the feathers and they get darker with age. So we know that she was an older bird just because she was quite dark. But she was found at a place called Dubbo, which is kind of out country New South Wales. And she was found unable to fly. She actually got handed into some carers there where they just tried to feed her up and release her. And once they released her, they found her about 100 metres away on the ground again. So it was pretty clear that she wasn't able to fly. So she ended up coming into Taronga and we decided that we wanted to try to work with her to see what we could do. Again, we have no idea really why she couldn't fly. The vets put it down to some kind of muscle myopathy. So she just had no strength in her wings, in her muscles. So when we started training her, we really just focused on the training style to help build strength. So it kind of turned into physio sessions, really. Training her to like fly up and down, so inclines and declines, because when you're flying up to something, that's really going to start working those pec muscles and building strength. So that's her story. With the peregrine falcon, actually, I called it Clarky after Peter Clark. He came in to the zoo because he actually had a broken wing. And normally what happens with birds when they come in with broken wings is they kind of get set, but the wing gets kind of strapped down to the body. And, you know, that's a technique that's okay for some birds. But for a peregrine falcon, as I was saying before, when I was describing them chasing the red tails, they need to be strong because they are such dynamic flyers. They need to be able to twist and turn throughout the air with the greatest of ease and travel at speeds of up to 380 k's an hour. So you can imagine a bird that had a broken wing that, you know, couldn't move it for a month. It would get quite stiff. It would really cause a lot of problems for release back into the wild. So this particular vet at the zoo came up with a new technique of trying to heal that wing, where she basically got a splint for it. But the way that she put it on the brake, it was still allowed the bird to open its wings fully. So it was pretty amazing what she was able to achieve. And because, again, it needed to be fit for release, she decided to hand it to me to try to train so we could do some flight strength, so we could do some flights with it to help strengthen its wings, but also to assess whether it was okay to be released. You know, once it's out flying, we really wanted to look at how it turned in the air and came back, and just to make sure that it was actually able to do it. And so I thought that was really a cool idea to be a part of. So I started training that bird for some free flight to assess it for release.
Cool. So let's go through these 10 steps now. So everyone listening, imagine your Erin at Tauranga. You've got a bird coming, two birds coming from the wild. You've got a wedge-tailed eagle, one of the largest eagle species in the world. There's some that are bigger than it, but it's a pretty big bird. They're a pretty big species. And the fastest animal in the world, basically, a peregrine falcon who needs that wing to be fully functional before release into the wild. What are the steps you're going to take to start training, start working with these animals using positive reinforcement?
All right. So you can imagine a bird that is from the wild that comes into care. When we're talking about positive reinforcement and what are the primary reinforcers, you know, even though food is a primary reinforcer, a lot of the time when they come in, they're a little bit too nervous that they don't even want to eat. So it's good to use food to pair it with you. But at first, I really think that using control of their environment, the control to get rid of you out of their space is one of the huge things. So step one is basically just throwing food in and walking away. So, you know, we pretty much have a weighed out amount of food that we might potentially want to give a bird. And we would just cut it into small pieces. And throughout the day, I might just walk past, open the door, throw food in, and then close the door and walk away. So what I'm basically saying is that every time that door opens, something good's going to happen, but I'm also leaving. So I'm not a threat. I'm going to disappear. And first off, you might have that food still just sit there on the floor. And so you might just assess how often you're going to do it, because you don't want to keep throwing food in if the food's just piling up, kind of thing. But eventually the bird will come down and eat it. And so you kind of want to judge the time, I guess, from when I've thrown that food in to when they're eating it. And so that's when you're kind of going to know when to go on to your next step. And every time I throw that food in as well, I'm always watching body language. I'm watching what that bird's doing. When I open the door, is it looking everywhere to see where it can escape to? Or is it going to start looking at me going, ha, oh, there's that lady that brings food, and kind of leaning forward on the perch, looking interested in what I'm doing, you know, the head's kind of moving, trying to see what I've got. And so once I start noticing that, I might throw the food in and maybe just wait at the door for a few seconds to see whether that bird will come down and eat in my presence. Because step number two is basically you wanting that bird to feel comfortable to eat while you're still like in the doorway. But then as soon as that bird does eat, I'm going to leave as well. So I guess I'm basically reinforcing the behavior of that bird eating by me disappearing as well. So then I'm going to try to eventually, again, read body language, watch what the bird's doing. But step three would be eating while I'm still in the aviary. So I might be able to just maybe sit right at the very door in the aviary and throw some food in and wait for that bird to kind of come down. Again, with all these steps, we're always going back and forward, because, you know, sometimes that me maybe being in that aviary just sitting at the front door might be too much, and the bird starts looking of where it can escape to. And as soon as I kind of see that, I know that I've kind of maybe pushed a little bit too far. So I might have to go back steps. But basically what I want to do is just have a few bits of food with me so I can just throw some food towards it. It will eat, and maybe I can throw another piece and another piece until this bird's feeling comfortable eating while I'm in that aviary. So then we go to step four, where I want to see the bird actively move towards me. So never do I really move towards that bird. I always want to see it come towards me. So again, it's the best way in this situation of giving this bird control and choice. So I might start throwing foods. Maybe that's just a little bit closer to me, so the bird actually has to walk towards me to get that food. And once I can see that bird's feeling comfortable and is eating pretty readily, I might then go to maybe the perch where that bird is standing, but encourage the bird to walk along the perch towards me. So again, putting some food on the perch so the bird will come in and eat until eventually I can actually, as I said before, put bits of food in my glove and reach my hand up high so it can actually take food from my glove. So that first time where that bird takes food from your glove is a pretty cool moment, I have to admit. You know, it's gone from being a bird that just does not want anything to do with you, looking for escape, to trusting you enough to be able to take food from your hand. So that was step five. So step six is actually getting that bird onto your glove. Now, with raptors, when they're eating at a carcass, you know, if they're pulling at a bit of food and it's not coming off cleanly, they will put their foot on that carcass to try to sturdy it and then use their beak to try to pull off that bit of food. And so we kind of use that same similar techniques for our gloves. So I might have a little bit of food and it's just so used to just being able to take food, but I might just hold on to it just for a little bit. And so once it's starting to pull and realize that my kind of hand's kind of going up with it and that the food's not coming easy, it might actually put its foot on my glove just to sturdy it. As soon as that foot comes onto my glove, I open up my fist and let it have that food. So I'm reinforcing. Again, it's all approximations. It's all about reinforcing those small steps to getting it closer to you. So eventually the bird is learning that it has to put its foot on my glove to get the food. And then eventually it might put both feet up and then you can hand it a few pieces in the glove. So it's just sitting and eating on your glove. Now, at any time that bird wants to leave my glove, I always let it leave. I never hold on to Jess's or, you know, I just want to let that bird know that being on my glove is a safe space. And if it chooses not to be on there, it has the ability to escape if it needs. And just with that builds the confidence and also builds the trust within us to keep going further on with our training. So once the bird is sitting on the glove, eating, feeling confident, then I might start moving around the aviary and actually just walking around with the bird on my glove. Again, being able to leave at any time. So at this stage, so with both of the birds, this is basically what we got up to. But now it's kind of getting time where we have to think about actually leaving the aviary so we can start this flying training process. So with Gina, the wedge-tailed eagle, we actually box trained her. So exactly like you would crate train your dog at home, we took the box into her aviary. She could kind of jump down into it, always had that ability to escape. All of the reinforcements were either around the box or with inside the box. So eventually she would go in, she could take some food and then she could come straight out again until she was quite keen to just jump inside that box. And we didn't start closing the door until she was feeling comfortable. And we also have like a bit of a hole in the side of the box. So while she's in there, I can just keep offering her lots of small pieces. So she, you know, thinks there's going to be more food. There's more reason to stay with inside that box. And when we do start thinking about closing the door, again, we give them control of that door. If at any stage they feel uncomfortable with the movement of the door, we just open it straight away so she can hop out. And as soon as she realizes she can, suddenly that movement of the door and the closing of the door, well, it doesn't really seem to be important because she knows that she can control it and get out if she needs to. Now with the peregrine falcon, actually, we didn't box train him. We actually used traditional falconry techniques. We actually used a hood. So a hood is just like a leather piece of a piece of leather that's been designed in the shape of the head. You might see in old photos of falcons and other birds of prey wearing this kind of funny leather thing on their head. But again, we trained him to wear it. We didn't just put it on his head and just expected him to accept it. We put little bits of food in there. So he actually had to stick his head all the way in to kind of get the food and take it on and off until eventually the hood goes on, then it comes off, you get a piece of food. So again, it's just that pairing a certain stimulus with reinforcement. And the reason why we did that with the falcon was it just makes it a bit easier to travel. You can just walk around with the bird on your glove and have that hood while we're traveling in the car and things like that. So again, if you have a crate with a dog in it at home and for whatever reason you might be traveling, there might be things that you don't know, you might put a blanket over the crate and it just makes it a little bit darker and makes them feel a bit more safe and secure. That's exactly what the box and the hood does. It provides that shelter and safety for that animal. But again, because it's paired with positive things, they're quite happy to wear it. So as we've talked about before, our bird show is on the top of a cliff. So if we wanted to start training any birds there, it's kind of not the most easiest place to train. We don't really have long spaces. And if they do happen to get up and, you know, they could be on the other side of the harbour. So a lot of the times we will put them in a car and we'll take them to a few different ovals that we have around Mosman. And the ovals that we tend to choose are ones that are at sea level. You know, they're nice big ovals, so lots of space, but also potentially surrounded by trees. And so that just gives the ability of when they do start to free fly, if they do kind of overshoot a station or anything like that, they might just end up in a tree. Or if they go for a bit of a fly around, they're not going to just take off over the harbour. So that's why we choose a few of the different areas that we have. So step 9 is creonce training. So again, this is going back to some falconry techniques, but and again, we would only use them for our birds' prey. So we used it both for Gina and for the falcon, where they are wearing jesses at that time, so we can hold on to them. And so again, that's important. If there's a dog off lead or something like that, we have that ability to hold on to them safely. But we also have a thing called a creonce, which is a long, thin line. And so that allows that bird to travel, you know, up to 50 meters while we're still kind of holding on to it. But the keeper that's holding on to the creonce does have to run because you don't want to drag a long piece of string against the ground. It can get a little bit heavy. So we try to keep the distance between the keeper and the bird quite short. So there's not much weight, but it just means that the keeper has to do some running. So that's always fun. So with Gina, we trained her to two things. We trained her to fly from glove to glove. So we would have two trainers there that we would call her and she would fly and land on our gloves. But we also used a station as well. So we tend to have these bins, which we turn upside down. They've got spikes on them so they can go into the ground. And then the base of the bin has got like some green kind of fake grass turf on it just to help protect it a little bit. So the bird will fly from one bin to another bin. And so basically we just get that bird out of the box and we start off really small flight. So it might even be just a meter from our glove to the bin. And then as we start getting the confidence that we need from the bird, we will start getting further distance. So again, approximations. So we will eventually have it lead up to, you know, it could be 50 meters flights back and forth that the bird has to do. Now, with the peregrine falcon, it's a little bit different because we actually do a thing called lure fly. And lure flying is where we have this bit of leather that's shaped, it's in the shape of a bird, and that's kind of tied to a bit of a rope. And so the end result will be you swing this leather lure around, and as the bird flies down to catch it, you feed it out, and the bird has to try to chase it. And it's a bit of a game of cat and mouse. It can be a bit tricky to get the timing down right, but if you get the timing down right, it should hopefully just miss it and fly up, and it has to turn around and come back to try to chase the lure. And eventually it catches the lure. It will come down to it and then it can come into your glove and get its reward. So this is the style of how we would train our falcons, because it's kind of cool to see them fly like that. We did have a bird that we would fly like that in show just to demonstrate just that speed and the technique of its flying. But it was probably really important for Clarkie, this peregrine falcon, because we don't want to just see this bird fly from A to B. We want to actually see it twist and turn in the air to come back to assess whether it's can physically do that or whether it's going to struggle to, because these are all going to be things that we have to think about before we say, yes, it can be released into the wild. And so with this training technique, again, we would still have the creonce attached to it, but we would tie a little bit of food to this leather lure and just drop it on the ground, and the bird just had to fly to this lure. And we could just do reps of that, and every time it would get a bit of food on the lure, but then it would come to our glove and get some food as well. And we would start moving that distance back and back and back until, you know, it was flying 50 meters to the lure. So once the birds are pretty much flying, you know, up to that 50 meters, it's getting a bit hard for keepers to keep up with them as they're flying when they're on creonce. So this is when we decide to do step 10, which is free flying. Now, free flying is so much fun, and there's so much nerves that go with it for the first couple of times. But again, you just reduce that criteria as well. These birds, you know, you set that bird up to succeed. So the first couple, you might just do those 50-meter flights or just let that peregrine falcon fly down to the lure. But then eventually you're going to have to put that lure out there and let it miss. And so as soon as that falcon flies past, you want to see it kind of go, put the brakes on and want to turn around. And straight away you drop the lure on the ground so it gets reinforced for coming back. Until eventually, again, with approximations, you're building it up to it misses. It has to fly around, come back. It misses. It has to fly around and come back until it eventually gets it. So once you get to that stage, then you know, you would pretty much say that you're at the end goal. And with the wedge-tailed eagle, you would do those 50-meter flights back and forth without that creant, so it's all free flying. These birds have got that telemetry, that GPS tracking device on them at this time. But what we really needed to do for Gina, again, it was about that incline and decline. So we started putting one of the stations on top of a hill and the other one down. So she actually had to fly up and down. And then we would start putting her into trees where she had to actually fly out of trees and things like that. So we're just building up her strength. So with Gina, it was all about strength building until we thought, whoa, she's actually doing really well. And so once we kind of felt like we've done all that we can off site, we started introduce training her to show. And Gina is now in our 3 o'clock show. And she flies nearly every day. She does have a bit of a wind cutoff because sometimes she's not like Reggie. Reggie does this amazing soaring and everything, but she's quite competent in flying down to her stations at in the tree. And she's such a unique bird. I've never actually met any bird like her. She's, you know, she's kind of undescribable within her personality, or Nick Bishop would hate me saying that word, personality, birdsonality maybe. But she's just such a gentle soul. So she flies in our 3 o'clock bird show now. So if anyone wants to come in and see her fly, that's the show to see her in. But I'd recommend seeing both the 12 o'clock show and the 3 o'clock show. And with the peregrine falcon, he did really well. And he ended up getting released into the wild. So, you know, it's kind of hard to track them from that point, but I really hope that he's doing well out there and feeding well. Hopefully got a chick or two that he's looked after. So, so they've been two of my main experiences at the show, and it's been pretty amazing to get to be a part of that. And one of the things we do say in the show when Gina flies is, you know, one of the coolest parts of the job is to be able to give a bird their wings back. And I think that's a pretty cool experience.
I got kind of emotional when you just said that.
I still do these days when I say it in the show too.
So let's go through those. And as I was thinking, you know, we're talking about birds of prey, but someone might be working with a shouter dog that's been brought in, that's lived its life out in the streets, or wild horses that get caught and brought in to be trained. So there's a lot of similarities, I think, between what you described there with the wedge-tailed eagle and the peregrine falcon to people working
with
different species.
Yeah, well, it's all that science, isn't it? It's all about behaviour change, and, you know, everything behaves for a reason, whether it's to searching for reinforcement or to try to get away from it. So it's the same techniques among, you know, even human animals as well.
So step one is throw food. So you got these birds and these aviaries, just throw the food in and walk away. Step two, you're waiting at the door, but you're throwing the food in.
Yeah, basically waiting for it to eat in your presence, and then leaving as soon as it does.
Cool. And then so that's step three. And then step four, you actually want to see the bird move towards you.
Yep.
Then you're going to move towards hand feeding, potentially if you're working with other species, but you've got this big thing called a gauntlet on, or a glove.
Yes, a gauntlet, yes. I might use that word from now on.
And you want this, I'm curious as to what part of the world that comes from now and how I have come to call it a gauntlet.
But it probably is a word. I'll give you that one. Probably from
maybe
Europe,
it's North America. I don't know. Anyway,
I don't know.
Someone will tell us. Then you put the food in the glove and you want to see that bird actually move towards you. That's step five, isn't it? putting the food in the glove.
Step five is, bird eats from your glove, basically, yeah.
So that'd be like hand feeding your horse maybe, or hand feeding a shelter dog with protective contact. So you might be behind a barrier when you're doing that. Number six is getting the bird onto your glove. And at this stage, you've mentioned the word trust so much, and I'm getting it, and I think an overall theme from this podcast episode, I'm getting this recurring, not idea, but important component of what we do. You've mentioned trust so many times.
Yeah, I think it's so important with any animal species, you know, or even human species. You know, we all know how important trust is in our own relationships. So trust within the animals that you work with, because I always find once you build that trust, that confidence within them, the training part is actually the easy part. it's really just building it up so they feel safe to do so.
Number seven, you're going to start to walk around with the bird on your glove. Number eight, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
Number eight, box training, hood training, and taking them out. So you're taking them. So you use the word oval. Can you just explain to everyone and to me, sorry, what an oval is?
Sorry, yes, of course. Right. So an oval is basically like a green space where people might play football. They might, you know, it's just a sports ground, a huge park. It doesn't necessarily, an oval is just, I guess, what we would call, just because of the shape of like our sports ground, it would be. So it's just a big open green space. Generally, it's lined with trees.
Cool. So you're taking a bird down there, and you're talking about wearing crayons. So I'm just thinking about dog training when you say that, and us wearing us people who work with dogs as well, because the dog's wearing it, not us. That would be weird. The dog wearing a long line, and so you've kind of got this point of attachment just in case. It's like training wheels.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Because at this point, you know, they're still not 100% confident within their environment. You've just taken them to a whole new place that they've never seen before. So you can't expect them just to be, happy just to hang around with you at that point. So especially, as I said, there could be other stimuli in that area that could be quite aversive. So just having that just in case, it's really important.
And then number 10 was free flying.
Yeah, that's right.
Pretty exciting and amazing that you got to release the Peregrine Falcon. And so cool. I hope people listening to the show can actually head to Tauranga and get to see Gina, and they can potentially see Erin as well, and you can go and say, hey, I listened to the show.
Yeah, that would be great. If anyone does, I'd love for them to come down and say that they heard this podcast, and that's, you know, that would be pretty cool.
Hey, that was absolutely amazing. I thoroughly enjoyed that, but I am a bird nerd at heart. So it's been a pleasure to talk about all of this stuff with you today. We do have one last question just before we finish up today, and this is a question I ask everyone and super keen to hear your offering on this today. We started off the show with where you got started, Erin. Now, though, I'd like to invite you to take us into the future. What kind of things do you want to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years? We can talk about the bird training world if you want, or the animal training world at large.
I just think that, again, I keep seem to quoting Susan Friedman here, but, she always says that this is the science now, but the science is always changing. And so it's just for us to all be open-minded. You know, it's so easy to get stuck in our own techniques and think that this is the only way, but to actually get out of your comfort zone and to explore different ideas and change with time, I think it's really valuable because even in the time that I've been training, you know, there's been so many little things that have changed that we don't do anymore. But I think, you know, the biggest thing is just trying to take that ego out of it. You know, a lot of the times when we train, you want to be open for feedback and not get too concerned if you make mistakes, and just, you know, embrace those mistakes. Because I always say there's no bad training session. There's just a whole lot of information that you can gain from it. So I guess relaxing a little bit, you know, even with me, a bit more with it, and be okay to make mistakes and be okay to, you know, just listen to the animal and change if you need to. I think they're the biggest things, I think, that would be cool, you know, for me and any trainer out there to listen to, you know, to go forward for the future.
Yeah, awesome. Amazing. I resonate with that very strongly. And I was just thinking as well, just before we do wrap up, just a nice little thing to tie it all together. As you mentioned, Reg is a bird I used to work with a long time ago in Cairns, and I had some challenges when I first started working with Reg, and I came to Tauranga Zoo. And I don't know if we met at that stage, but I met Nick Bishop.
I think I might have said hi in the background kind of thing, and maybe I was busy doing something else, but I think I definitely did meet you just for a split second.
You definitely were extremely kind to me at a later visit, showing me around and spending time showing me some of your training and your birds. But at this time, Nick kindly offered to help me train Reg, the wedge-tailed eagle, who was living at Cairns at the time when I was working with him, the one that Aaron's been talking about in this episode. And we just did pretty much the process that you just described here. So I did that with Reg.
Oh, okay.
Just to build my relationship. So
it's that's neat. Cool. And it worked well for you?
Yeah, it worked fantastic. And me and Reg had an amazing relationship. But it was all coming from Tauranga. It was all coming. And Nick was saying that he was going and talking to the team and getting ideas and coming back to me. So you would have been one of that team. And there you go. Tying it all together at the end.
Yeah.
Well, one of the best teachers I've ever had, Reg the wedge-tailed eagle.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we've all had one of those birds, hasn't it, that's just taught us so much.
Amazing. I can't wait until next time I'm in Sydney and I can come and see you and come and see Reg.
That'd be great.
Tell the weather gods or whatever they are to make sure it's 50 kilometers an hour southerly on that day. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, you'll get a good 10-20 minutes of viewing of him flying if that's the case.
Hey, thanks so much for everything today, Erin. It's been an absolute blast. We really appreciate you making time to come and hang out with us here at Animal Training Academy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been so much fun.
It's been an absolute blast. Everyone listening, we appreciate you tuning in today as well. And if you've enjoyed this episode and you're interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, and as mentioned at the start of the episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior nerds. There's something there for absolutely everyone. We're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.